and he's got a whole epic, grandiose storyline featuring Waldo the Cat. It's incredible. He really like takes a look at early animation, vaudevillian people concepts, and plays with it, makes it dirtier, makes it darker, but beautiful. He's an incredible storyteller. Boulevard of Broken Dreams and Alias the Cat are one of the strongest releases over the last while. They kind of go under the radar. A lot of people don't really like check it out, but Pantheon Books, who's very selective of the comics they release, they only do stuff like Mouse, Persepolis, Jimmy Corrigan, stuff like that. Those two books are published by Pantheon, Chip Kids Company. And I really highly recommend checking them out. They're fantastic books, and Kim Deitch was a delight to talk to, and he was so awesome that we actually got to talk to him for 2 hours. 2 hours nonstop. Me and Robert Dayton talking to Kim Deitch. It was more than 2 hours. I think maybe even 2.5. I think it was about 2.5 hours. Wow. So Robert Dayton and I chatted with Kim. I'm featuring the first hour of conversation mixed in with a little bit of music, because Kim's got some interesting taste in music, and he sent me a whole bunch of stuff to play. So I've got some of that coming in with this episode, and I think you're going to enjoy it. He's a really fascinating guy. He's got lots to talk about, a lot of different stuff. Really interesting anecdotes of his career. After he was in New York, he moved to San Francisco and was part of the underground scene there. And he's just been really nonstop doing great work. His stuff hasn't really... His style is very similar to how it was back in the day, but it's just so pristine and refined. And it's like, he's an example of an artist who's really like found what he's doing and perfected it. And I recommend checking out his books. And hear him talk about his new book that's coming out at some point with his brothers. One of his brothers is a member of the Churches of Genius. God, I can't even remember his name now. It ends with Fishmonger. I know that much. Ahmed Fishmonger, I think that's what it was. I think it's Ahmed Fishmonger. Really interesting family. His dad, Gene Deitch, was an animator, worked on Turtle Thompson for Captain Kangaroo. That's what it was. And has since relocated to Czechoslovakia. I guess it's warmer there in the summer or something. No, I don't know. Take a listen. We chat a bit about that. We chat a bit about this. And it's fun. It's great. And the other two parts to the interview will be featured on inkstuds.com. I'll probably have them up tonight. I just wanted to, you know, first play the first part of the interview on air with CITR because I love being a part of CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And I hope you love it too. Next week's guest isn't necessarily comics, but fascinating nonetheless. It's my show. As I like to say, I can do what I want, so damn you all to hell. I think you'll like this interview, though. It's Genesis Peorage, who history of fantastic experimental music, art. He was friends with Burroughs in the 70s, Burroughs and Brian Gysin, member of Throbbing Gristle and Coombe Transmissions that really changed music and created a new way of listening to things and crazy awesome goodness, and has since his project Psychic TV. Really fascinating person. Check him out, Genesis Peorage. A week after that will be Farrell Dalrymple, Meat House's own, who'll be on to discuss the Omega Man project he's doing for Marvel, as well as he's coming to town for Comic-Con on August 26th, I think it is, at Heritage Hall that Leonard puts on. Come down, check it out. As well, 23rd will be Chris Ware and Jeet here to discuss Gasoline Alley. I'm really excited about that. And hopefully the 30th projected should be Mr. Jim Woodring. And I think you're going to love that one because Jim's a very interesting guy and a beautiful artist. His stuff is just incredible. And I think you all should check it out. And I think just, oh yeah, one other thing. Saturday night at the Blim, Owen and Terry Plummer, superstar couple, artist couple, are putting on a thing at the Blim. Check it out. Julian Lawrence's band will be playing Les Poutines, and check it out. Inkstead, CITR, 101.9 FM. ¶¶
I'm waiting for ships that never come in. Watching and waiting in vain. That in the distance, sailing across the sea. My ship? Why, my ships are coming. They're sailing home to me. With wealth and love and happiness, my sorrowing days have passed. Gee, it's the end of my watching and waiting, and my ships have come at last. It seems that life's stormy seas hold nothing for me, but broken dreams and shattered schemes. I'm waiting for ships that never come in. I wonder where they can be. Those are not my ships. I'm waiting for ships that never come in. I wonder where they can be.
I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us. I'll give you a little detail. I don't know if you checked out our website about the show, but we're focusing on alternative and independent cartoonists, and as much as we can talk to underground guys.
Yeah.
I did an interview with Spain, I guess, about a year and a half ago that was lots of fun. And kind of
again?
I did an interview with Spain about, about a year and a half ago, and he was a great guy to have on. And
yeah, Spain's a real raconteur.
And I'll just say who I've got here with me. My co-host for this interview. It's his name's Robert Dayton.
Hi there.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great. How are you?
I'm fine.
All right.
And so we have a lot of questions. I hope you're up for a pretty thorough examining. I guess I don't know if examining, but we're both big fans of your work, so we have a lot to ask about kind of where you come from and what's going on with your work and yada yada yada.
Well, fine. I mean, you know, fine.
Excellent. I guess I'll start out with the quick one. We have a bunch of questions about your kind of some biographical questions because you come from, I guess, an artistic lineage.
Well, my old man's in the animation business. That's kind of where it starts. So I guess we're two generations deep.
Wow. Can I step in? This is the embarrassing question, but the thing that makes it very exciting for it to be a show on radio after having read comic books for so many years is how to properly pronounce cartoonist names.
Yeah, right.
How do I properly pronounce your last name after reading it for so long?
It's Deitch.
Deitch.
Okay,
thank you very much.
We had Dan Nadel on last year, and he corrected us on it, I think.
I think I was calling him Natal.
Yeah, my old man was calling him that, too, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really?
Because we both did a thing with Dan late last year.
Oh, what did you do?
It was a symposium over at Parsons School of Design.
Was that the slideshow-type lecture that you have online right now?
No. The one that's online, I think that one goes back a few. That was the show I was doing when I was promoting the Boulevard of Broken Dreams. It's like from Florida, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've gotten a lot better since then.
So what did this symposium entail that Dan Nadel organized?
Well, I guess, you know, it was just about, it wasn't just us, it was various people in the graphic arts business, and I don't know, since he included my father in that book that he did, what was it called? Oh, Art Out of Time.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a friend of Dan's. I'd spoken in front of his class before. And, you know, me and my father were pretty good together. You know, we've done radio together and stuff. So, you know, it was a good idea for him.
Oh, great.
You know, we can put on a pretty good dog and pony show between us.
If you could refresh my memory, oh, sorry, I don't want to step on. If you could refresh my memory, what was of your father's in that Art Out of Time book again? What was included?
What it was an excerpt from his comic strip Terrible Thompson, which is something he did in the mid-50s for United Features, and which is now out in complete form in a book by Fantagraphics.
And it's beautiful. It's full color. It's a great book.
Yeah. My father did really good work in pepping up those old strips on Photoshop.
And that was eventually turned into a cartoon for Captain Kangaroo, was it?
It morphed into a cartoon on Captain Kangaroo. In fact, my father had kind of an interesting link in that morphing. When we did the thing at Parsons, he showed a one-shot pilot for something called Terrible Tessie, where he turned Terrible Thompson into a girl, and which ran about 6 minutes.
Was it still the same basic concept, where it's a child that interacts with famous people all throughout history, but without traveling through time?
That's the one, yeah.
So what type of famous people did Terrible Tessie encounter?
Terrible Tessie encountered only one famous person, Christopher Columbus, which was also the first one, Terrible Thompson's first adventure as well.
Right, right. Now, your father was also very, very, very famously involved with a lot of animation studios.
Yeah.
Which studios?
Bert and Harry Peel for the Peel's Beer Campaign. That was immense.
Wow. And this stuff is also heavily listed in the that book, Cartoon Modern?
Because I don't think I've seen that book.
It's really a great book because it talks about moving away from the centerline school of animation and moving into more modern, a more modernist type of animation that your father was seems to be a very heavy influence.
From the title.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about some of the, as a young guy, were you into comics at all, or is it more your kind of influence? Because I read somewhere about being an animation brat.
Yeah, I was into comics, the one that I was really into that made the big impression on me, and this will come as no surprise, because you know you'll hear it from everybody. You know, the EC comics. I wasn't really into the horror so much, but Mad Comics, the four color comic book, was just, you know, my absolute favorite. And, you know, I was even not allowed to read it at first. You know, my mother found a copy of it under my mattress. There was a big to-do about it. But actually, that was kind of interesting. That was the one time my old man stood up to my mother. We were on vacation, and the issue of Mad came out that had Alice in Wonderland on the cover. And when, you know, the first thing you see when you opened up the comic was Gasoline Valley, this really brilliant send-up of Gasoline Alley, illustrated by Bill Elder.
I just remember that.
They were looking at that at some stand in Pennsylvania, and you know, my father was just as wowed by it as I was. My mother came up and she goes, "Kim, you know you're not supposed to look at that book." And my father, so fascinated with it, he said, "That's all right, Marie. This is a good book. He can look at it." And, you know, so that was like, boy, you know, that was a big breakthrough. And then, you know, right on top of that, it must have been about less than a year later, Harvey Kurtzman was kind of fishing around for some animation projects and sent my father, like, not the complete run of Mad Comics, but he must have, you know, like two-thirds of the run of Mad, and in which my father promptly turned over to me. It was like, you know. Of course, you know, that was interesting, because, you know, essentially, he wasn't really into comic books. I mean, I think my parents subscribed to the Pogo comic, but in general, they considered that stuff to be trash. But he was, you know, really revered comic strips, and there were, like, there were a lot of books about comic strips lying around the house. So I was up on all of that stuff, even, you know, even before I could read, I was looking at those books and just looking at the pictures. By the time my father was actually doing a comic strip, I was into it. You know, plus, yeah, he managed to subscribe to enough out-of-town newspapers so he had access to every syndicated comic strip being published in the mid-50s, you know. There's anything I wanted to see in comic strips, it was right there. In fact, I even had the job of cutting Popeye out every day and pasting him up in the pages of an issue of the New York Post so that my old man could review Popeye at his leisure every week. So, yeah, you know. And plus, you know, there's my father. He comes home from the cartoon studio, and it was hell on his marriage, but the way it would go is he comes home, eats some dinner, pads upstairs to his little moonlighting setup, and starts working on a comic strip. Well, you know, if you're doing comics, one thing you find out quick enough is there's a lot of work. You know, a lot of times you just want to be by yourself so you can concentrate, but there's plenty of other times where there's just a lot of busy work where you'd be only too happy to have somebody to talk to. I mean, pages I'm working on right now, I could be filling in the blanks talking to you. I'm not. So
go right ahead.
No. Do it. The strip or you any good, really. But it, you know, it was great for me and my old man at the time because he was only too happy to, you know, show me how it was done and talk about it all, you know. But it really brought us closer together. I mean, you know, he was starting to talk about, well, you know, one of these days maybe you can be my assistant on the strip. Gosh, really, Dad? You know, of course, you know. A certain book. You know, the strip might have even gone on. I mean, part of the reason the strip stopped after 6 months is my mother couldn't stand it, you know. She just, like, you know, was working all day, working all night. You know, it was, and, you know, it was bad for the marriage, you know, that workaholic thing. You know, and to this day, she's still down on me for the same thing, you know. You know, she just feels the way I go at it. You know, it's like it's not the way a human being ought to live.
Well, there's a lot of talk in comic circles about your legendary stature at working 16-hour days.
Well, you know, you got. I've been thinking about that in terms of some other people that I, you know, whose work I like. Is, you know, it's one thing to have the talent, but you've also got to have that motor behind it all. Mm. You know, it's gonna keeps you going. You know, you got to have this sort of self-motivator thing going all the time. You got to be one step ahead of yourself all the time. You got to, you got to really want to be great, you know, to even have a chance at maybe being great. You know, you're never going to make it if you're not really, you know, trying to put out a major effort in that direction.
And it shows.
In other words,
you got to
toughen yourself up. Is what it is. And you know. Yeah, it makes, you know, being around a person like that can be trying. You know, I'm very lucky. My wife is pretty understanding. Well, you know, she's got a high-pressure job herself, so...
And she's actually quite an excellent artist as well.
Pardon me?
She's an excellent artist as well.
Yeah.
Pam,
yeah, you know,
Butler.
One of these times I hope we can work together, you know. In fact, you know, when I was first coming up with Alias the Cat, my original concept was that was going to be something, a strip that we could do, the two of us. But once I got rolling on it, you know, it just seemed like, I don't know, it just wasn't happening. You know, she was kind of pissed at me for a while because of that. But one of these days, I think we'll find something to work on together. I mean, I show her everything I do. She gives me good advice. She's a good critic. I mean, she's something of mine that isn't really up to par. She'll tell me, you know, which is, it's good to have something like that, somebody around like that that'll do that too. Because... you know, you can jolly yourself into doing a mediocre thing if you're not careful.
Mm. Getting back to the Mad Magazine thing and your mother, I've seen one strip of yours where you draw your home life and you describe your parents as being a hot pink politically, I believe it was.
Right.
And I'm so shocked that your mother at first wouldn't let you read Mad after seeing this illustration of what your home life was like with the bongos and.
Yeah. Well, you know, she was actually, you know. And, you know, when all that Wortham stuff come out, you know, when it was being serialized in magazines, she was reading all those magazines and going to her women's clubs and participating in all that stuff. So we were right in the cutting edge of not only, you know, really being on the inside of how comics are done, but also when all that censorship thing was going down, you know, we had an active participant in that movement right in the house as well. So, you know, and what did it get her? I mean, you know, look at the way I turned out.
15 years later.
And my brothers, too. I mean, you know, we're, I don't know. I don't know. You know, it's, I don't know what point I'm trying to make with this.
Well, your dad moved to Czechoslovakia in 1960. Did your mother move as well?
No, that's the thing, and that was the end of their marriage. Could you turn your volume up a little more?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm hearing you, but it's like I'm straining for it.
Oh, I'm sorry. How's that?
Better.
That's better?
Okay. Yeah, actually, let me try something really quick.
Okay.
We're
not going over. Are we live?
It's not live,
now?
No.
No.
No, I don't think we are.
Yeah, I'm hoping we can have like a nice, if you're up for it, a good chunk of time just to go through all your stuff. Because, like I said, we're both.
Come again. It's getting lower again.
It's lower again?
Now I can hear you good.
Okay. I was just saying, I hope we have a good chance to kind of go through all your work. And, like we said, like we're talking about the biographical stuff. And then later I'll probably split it up, hopefully, into a couple of episodes to be played at a later date.
That's fine. You know, like in for a penny, in for a pound. You know, you've been waiting a while to do this. I'm here. You're here. Let's do it.
Great. I read an interesting quote from that you said about your father. He said that you would never make it as an animator.
Yeah. Well, I think he was quite right. Hmm. You know, I'm not like a natural-born artist. You know, I'm really more like a writer who draws. You know, I have my way with it. But, you know, actually, in today's world, maybe I could make it in animation. I mean, you know, things have changed so much. But, you know, I lived for 11 years with a girl making animated cartoons and did all kinds of work on those cartoons. So.
I saw that online. Those were some of the Sally Cruikshank cartoon?
So, I, you know, I'm just not particularly interested in doing it. But, you know, he was right. You know, there's a certain kind of fluid, facility-driven kind of drawing ability that makes for a good animator. And that ain't me.
And I've heard of other situations somewhere where Mark Kalasniko, I don't know if you know his work.
Who?
Mark Kalasniko.
No,
he did a fantastic book for, got a couple of books for Fantagraphics. One's Mail Order Bride.
Yeah, maybe I've heard the title.
And he went and worked for Disney for a while and then just couldn't keep up with the technological changes, but he's just a gorgeous drawer. Like, his stuff is just so fluid. But it's such a different medium now.
Yeah,
that
well,
doesn't translate
you know,
the same.
Animation is good for guys who are really good technicians, and it's also good for guys who can draw but don't necessarily know what they want to draw. You know, if you just want to be a company man or something, it's a good place to put down roots and do your thing.
And I guess that would be a problem because as a writer, you don't if you are able to do an animated story, it would be from what I understand, pretty filtered through, you know, executive channels at that point because there's so much that goes into doing a cartoon.
Yeah, I think it's better now. I mean, you know, now they've got a lot of computer programs. I think, you know, like, we've reached the point now where, well, like, one person actually could probably do a pretty credible animated cartoon. But that's really an extremely recent development.
And you've recently had one of your stories turned into an animated cartoon, The Ship That Never Came In.
Yeah, I worked with John Kuramoto, who also like an anomaly that couldn't have existed until recently, who's a great animator who doesn't really draw.
Mm.
But he's really good at taking, you know, other people's artwork and timing it and giving it everything it needs to do the job. Like, you know, with that, I hired him to do that for me, and he told, you know, and then I drew the pictures, but he told me what pictures he wanted, came up with some business that I hadn't thought of, you know, that would work in terms of, you know, real time and whatnot. And it was an interesting experience.
Well, it's got a really, it's got a lovely use of, that's so modern, yet it uses such a 1929 vaudeville song.
Yeah, well, you know, what it was is, you know, I'm not really a record collector. I guess I'm more of a record accumulator. But, at one point, I found that record of Waiting for Ships by Art Gilliam. first of all, I thought, as soon as I heard it, there was this recognition, like somewhere on some TV show growing up, I saw that routine. You know, I don't know where it was or when it was, but, you know, there was a shock of recognition, first of all. And then second of all, I thought, Jesus Christ, that would just be great in a cartoon. You know, and then years later, suddenly when I'm doing all this stuff, I did a comic strip of it. I didn't even have my hands on the record at the time. That was in storage somewhere.
And that strip's in Boulevard, right?
No, it isn't. You know, that's the other reason why that one ended up being a comic strip, because, you know, Chip Kidd said, no, you know, there's all this color in it. We really can't afford to use that. And I was really, sort of crestfallen, you know, because I had all this nice color work and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, look, you know, if we're not going to use it in the book, could we, you know, I knew that Kurumoto had done some animation stuff for Klaus and Chris Ware. I said, look, couldn't we do a cartoon for it to promote the book? And he said, yeah, well, okay, I'll sign on for that.
Is he the same person that did the Chris Ware, This American Life cartoon? With the kids,
well, whatever cartoon, you know, that, you know, if you go to the Pantheon website, that's promoting Chris Ware.
Oh, okay, it's on.
You know, it's been so long, I can't remember what the hell it was.
That's probably not the one I'm thinking of, then.
Yeah, I didn't know there was any other animation of Chris's.
It was for the, I think, Showtime show, for the radio show, This American Life. There's a, I guess, a 10-minute animation based on Chris Ware's art. I don't know what factor he had in it, but it's pretty blatantly Chris Ware style.
Oh,
and
the
thing.
Like it's a Chris Ware knockoff.
No, he was involved in
oh,
the process.
Right.
Yeah.
He's so modest, he never mentioned that to me.
I got to say, with The Ship That Never Came In, I mean, the use of the tone and color in that, the sepia tone and the color, and, you know, going back and forth, and even the theme of the song tying into the theme of the cartoon, it's quite great.
Yeah, you know, I it was something that, you know, yeah, I got the record, like, when I was living with my girlfriend who made the cartoons, and, you know, there was a big lag between then and then, you know, at a later point I did the strip, and then at a still later point I was in a position to do the cartoon, and at that point I'd been reunited with the record, so everything fell into place.
Just one more chance to prove it's you alone I care for. Each night I say a little prayer for just one more chance, just one more night to taste the kisses that enchant me. I'd want no others if you'd grant me just one more chance. I've learned the meaning of repentance. Now you're the jury at my trial. I know that I should serve my sentence. Still I'm hoping all the while you'll give me just one more word. I said that I was glad to start out, but now I'm back to cry my heart out for just one more chance. We spend our lives in groping for happiness. I found it once and tossed it aside. I've paid for it with hours of loneliness. I've nothing to hide. I'd bury my pride for you. Just one more chance. I've learned the meaning of repentance. Now you're the jury at my trial. I know that I should serve my sentence. Still I'm hoping all the while you'll give me just one more word. I said that I was glad to start out, but now I'm back to cry my heart out for just one more chance.
Well, I really hope... Are there going to be more cartoons? I really want to see one of Mishkin's experimental cartoons, Monkey Doodle. I'd like to see Monkey Doodle as a cartoon.
Monkey Doodle, yeah. Well, you know, I do animation work. I did something for... what's the group called? They Might Be Giants.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, you know, I think one of their recent DVD or something, they never sent me a copy, but it was really done on the cheap, but, you know, they had me storyboard like a one-minute cartoon for them.
It's up on YouTube.
Is it?
Yeah, it's up on YouTube.
Yeah, well, that seems like just the place for it.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen it. You know, the trouble with it is, you know, they just, like, used my... storyboard sketches for the animation extremes, and you know, they were nice storyboard drawings, but it, you know, pressed into service for the animation, it looks a little raggedy.
Mm.
I was hoping to get Tony Eastman, a buddy of mine, to do the animation, but he wasn't willing to do it for the money they were offering, which is too bad because he would have known when to take me literally and when to kind of push the envelope himself. Because you know, we've done a couple of spots together. We did a Nickelodeon spot. We did a MTV spot. I mean, you know, every now and then somebody comes along and hires me, and I do a job. But that's just fine. That's just about as much animation as I'm interested in doing. You know, what I want to do, do comics. I mean, you know, it's movies on paper. You know, and well, yeah. Actually, but you know, having said that, you know, funny thing that's happening to me right now is, I seem to be morphing out of comics into more like illustrated fiction. I mean, the book I'm doing right now, which is the book I'm doing with my two brothers, is going to be called Deitch's Pictorama, and it is, in fact, illustrated fiction as opposed to comics. Although I'm experimenting with the medium, like the two pages I'm working on right now, I got them in front of me. It's a major two-page splash panel spread, and I occasionally use balloons, but... it's a proper short story, and all the stories in that book are going to be that way. And in fact, really, like the one I'm doing now, it's like 77 pages.
I guess, man.
You know, it doesn't, to call it a novella might be a reach, but it sure is a long, short story. And I'm really kind of thinking, no matter what I end up doing beyond that, I think I got a novel in me. You know, but it would be, you know, with pictures, because, you know, all this highfalutin talk about the graphic novel, at first I'm thinking, well, that's really pompous, you know, but then on the other hand I'm thinking, well, yeah, graphic novel. I mean, you know, it's not like we haven't had them before. You know, you look at the original editions of Dickens, and they're, you know, they've all got all these pieces of artwork in there that Dickens commissioned and chose.
Alice in Wonderland.
Off his prose. You go look at Vanity Fair. It's got 190 illustrations by Thackeray himself. I mean, I'm thinking this might be a good time to really get back to experimenting with the whole concept of the illustrated novel. I mean, you know, comics are great as far as they go, but I also feel that, like, you know, there are certain things that books do that comics can't do, and that this, you know... This is really kind of an interesting time to experiment with maybe coming up with a hybrid medium. I mean, you know, we've had some good experiments along those lines recently. For instance, Diary of a Teenage Girl by Phoebe Gluckner.
Yeah.
But then also what's sort of interesting me is now we're starting to get a lot of people entering the lists of graphic novels who aren't necessarily coming from comics doing interesting stuff. Like I saw a book, somebody... gave me, it was, I guess it's ostensibly a kid's book, but it's really fat about some kid who's hanging around in the 1930s, and he becomes friends with George Millais after his career is kaput, and he's running a little candy stand. And, you know, he cooks up this fantasy story about the kid and Millais, but he experiments with using words and pictures in intriguing ways that are kind of completely different from what you see in these comic-oriented so-called graphic novels or Diary of a Teenage Girl, other experiments along those lines, where he'll actually come to a passage where, you know, he's had text for a while, and then it goes to pictures, and then he's got picture, you know, for maybe 15 pages, so you're flipping them so fast, it's almost like a flip book. And I'm thinking, like, you know, I didn't absolutely love this book, but then I thought, but, you know, this is an interesting innovation in how you dish out words and pictures. And I think, you know, I think it's time to start looking for some other innovations along those lines, you know, not just to be showboating, but just, you know, maybe, you know, the comics medium itself can be retooled a little and improved a little. I mean, you know, what I think I'm missing, comics are great, but what I'm missing in comics that you get in books is, you know, you have the opportunity to get a, like, interesting interior dialogue of the characters and that sort of thing. You know, so, like, let's find a way to restore some of that. And then I think, you know, we might really be on to something. And that is kind of what I'm trying to do right now.
I think the Phoebe Glockner example is really an excellent example of a success in trying to experiment with something. And there's also some neat stuff. Like, I think S. Clay Wilson did a book with Burroughs.
Yeah.
Which, Tornado Alley, I can't remember. Sitting at home somewhere in stacks of stuff. Which wasn't necessarily as comic-y, but still was like a good use of the artwork with the story kind of working together as more of a collaboration than necessarily, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, my immediate response to reading the Phoebe book was, in, you know, I thought, well, maybe I can have, in the comic strip I'm doing now, maybe I can have a passage of illustrated fiction within the story, because, you know, in Alias the Cat, there's a passage where suddenly they discover these oral history tapes made by this woman in a nut house in 1965. And I thought, well, look, you know, here's a place where I could get into this character's head if I step out of a comic medium and into the proper prose medium with pictures. So, you know, I got a 13-page passage in the midst of the rest of Alias the Cat. You know, and that might have been as far as it went, but then, you know, I've been watching the stuff my brother Simon has been doing in this fanzine called Mineshaft, and my youngest brother Seth has been doing some pretty good just straight-ahead fiction writing, and I thought, you know, maybe this is the time, you know, to get involved with them and do a book with them. And when we sat down and started talking about it, it seemed like they were sort of in the same place of, you know, what, you know, it's particularly like my brother Simon, it particularly surprised me. What he seemed to be into wanting to do was doing some kind of illustrated fiction himself, which was a big surprise to me because he's kind of the person that kept my nose in comics at a time in my life where I was drifting away from that. You know, he's like 3 years younger than me. When I got to be about 20, you know, I sort of hit that, oh, I'm going to put away childish things, you know, and started reading regular books. He kept, you know, and I even used to kind of look down on him because he kept on reading comics. But, you know, as a result, he was there, you know, like when Amazing Adult Fantasy turned into the first issue of Spider-Man and the first issue of the Fantastic Four came along. You know, he started showing me those things and saying, like, look at this. I mean, you know, these guys are sort of going back to, like, those cool Captain Marvel comics we used to read when we were kids. And, you know, that there was sort of a revival of what was kind of charming and interesting about the initial comic books sort of making a comeback in the early 60s. And that definitely was one of the influences on me that made me start thinking about, you know, when I'd hit a point of, well, what am I going to do with my life? You know, I went 2 years through art school, wasn't fitting in there. At a certain point, I took a leave of absence, joined the Norwegian Merchant Marine, knocked around the world a little bit, came back, was working a lot of straight jobs. Then I'm about 20 years old, and I'm thinking, what the fuck am I going to... I'm sorry.
No. We're in Canada.
What am I
going
to do with my life? And I started, that's when I started thinking, get back into art. And while I'm experimenting with art, I'm also being exposed to not only Simon showing me what's going on in Marvel Comics in particular, but also just about that time, the Metropolitan Museum of Art did a show on Winsor McCay, which absolutely floored me. That was 1966, So between Marvel Comics and Winsor McCay, I started thinking, well, if I'm going to be going to art, maybe there's something in this comics thing. And what really put the tin hat on it was one of my coworkers at the straight job I had at that point, I showed him the art I'd been doing, and it was morphing into comics, little by little, till I actually had done like the first Waldo page at a certain point around 1966. And he was looking at that, and he was going, this is pretty good. Why is, you might be able to do something, it's drawn as good as Captain High. And so I said, Captain High, what's that? He said, it's some comic they run in this underground newspaper called East Village Other. I said, oh, yeah. He said, and soon after that, he shows it to me. And, I'm sorry.
Don't worry. I'll just do a listener discretion at the beginning of the thing. We're in Canada, so.
I don't usually do that. I'm sorry.
I'm a truck driver, so.
Radio. Anyway, it made me think, maybe there's a chance for me. Maybe I could go down there and get some work, So what I ended up doing is I had like $500 saved. I know it sounds like a pitifully small amount of money, but I quit my job, took $500, went down to the Lower East Side, and I'd say 10 days later, I had stuff appearing in the East Village Other. That was the good news. The bad news was there was no pay.
And that was working with Spain at that point, right?
That's where I met Spain. The pay I got, I met the guy who did Captain High, and he turned me into a marijuana dealer. So I was sort of supporting myself doing that. And at a certain point, when my strips started catching on, they started giving me copies of the paper so I could go over to Washington Square Park and sell them. It was sort of, going nowhere. At a certain point, I thought, this isn't getting me anywhere. I went and took the civil service test for the post office and got a job working for the post office. And I found a guru. I quit drinking. I got into meditation. I was feeling perfectly happy. But creatively, all the punch was leaving my work really in a bad way.
Yeah, you said in one quote, you said that yoga really killed your drive. Did it really kill your drive, yoga?
Well, at that time, I do some yoga arm exercises now. It's just great for my drawing arm. Mm. But, it was all on a more mystical level. Actually, the thing that was really good at that time that was really working for me in this amazing way was all the mantras they had us chanting. Those things were, talk about something that straighten you out. I was drinking too much. I went there, walked into this yoga institute. Just the first day sitting around chanting these mantras, it's like quitting drinking was like taking off a coat. Nothing to it. I just stopped, just like
I
that.
I know the
I
feeling.
I started becoming very well adjusted. It was very odd.
You don't drink today either?
I went back to drinking after that, but I haven't had a drink in, since like 1982 or 3, something like that.
Wow, congrats.
Well, I had to quit because, I've got a bad gene for drinking, and, it's either all or nothing with me. nothing would... It would be the end of me if I started drinking.
I was wondering that because when there's a couple things. The one character you have, the animator Mishkin, you really see how drinking affects him and affects his life. And also, there's also a cartoon caption of you at a meeting. So,
yeah. Hey, it's great. If you can handle it, great. It's a tonic. You have a couple of drinks every day. It's probably just the thing. I got a lot of Irish genes, there's a history of that sort of thing on my mother's side of the family. No, can't do it. So
there's a couple contradictory bios I've read of you, and one, for example, is the biography that's in Comics Book said that you were in the Marines with no prior interest in comics until you and your brother saw the Winter McKay exhibit in 1966.
Yeah, well, you know, somebody wrote that. Because, you know, I don't even remember it that well.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's not true.
The other thing is, in Ajax, there's a bio that says that you were a member of the Republican Party.
Oh, that's true.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I was a Republican for a while. I used to hang out at the American Opinion Library, you know, that the John Birch Society operated out of. And,
was it sort of a rebellion?
You try out different things, yeah. You know. I thought they had some points, you know. I got over it, but you know, I hate them now. Of course, well, what's going on now is even I think most Republicans are horrified. You know, it's beyond just being Republican.
It's shades of Nixon at this point.
You know, it's more like they're trying to hijack the government. You know, it's almost like a fascist takeover that all you know. I don't think it works. It isn't going to work, but I think it's about as close as we come to something like that in my lifetime.
Yeah.
Staying on the idea of talk of politics, you were working with Spain in '68,
yep.
And I know he went to the Chicago convention that year.
Yeah.
Were you involved in any kind of political stuff at that point?
I was supposed to go to Chicago too, but I didn't. I just didn't go. I didn't really approve of what was going on in Chicago. What did those guys do? They gave us Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
You know, I knew all those people. You know, I really didn't like them. You know, I probably sort of did have that hippie religion for a while. Like, I remember going to a human being in Central Park in 1967, and it was like this magical experience. There was something about it that is hard to describe. I think the only drugs I had in me that day is that I had a couple of martinis, you know. I was still segueing out of being a Republican. But then the next year, I was really looking forward to it, and it was like, you know, the yippies just like had kind of hijacked the thing, you know, and were trying to turn it into a political deal. And I really resented it, you know, and I knew some of those guys. You know, I knew Abby Hoffman, and I knew enough about him to know that he was kind of corrupt and full of shit himself. And
well, you guys were in the same area of New York, weren't you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he was around. You know, he was in and out of the East Village other office. One of my girlfriends used to go out with him. You know, my basic experience with him is he tried to get me in some comic book called Conspiracy Capers that he wasn't going to pay me for. Which, you know, I think I did do some art for one of Jerry Rubin's books, but it wasn't because I had any love for Jerry Rubin, but, you know, his wife sort of came upon me at the East Village Other when I was having a really bad hangover and brought me some aspirin, and she was kind of charming and engaging, and it was a favorite of her that I did the work in Rubin's book. Although I gotta say, boy, those illustrations paid and paid and paid for years.
Which book? Through repressings?
I think it was called Do It.
Oh.
You know, one of his stupid diatribe things.
I didn't even know you. Wow.
You know, it's nothing to know. It's just, you know, it's just, you know, a stupid job that came along. And like I said, I did it because I thought his wife was kind of an interesting person. Talking to her, I suddenly was getting an insight into what was driving Jerry Rubin. You know, it's like, I think it was probably his smarter wife. I'll play a picture later on.
With the East Village Other, who is Joel Fabricant? What did he do that was so important there?
Oh, Joel was really, I would say, you know, like, as far as I'm concerned, he's the man who really gave me my first break.
Mm.
See, what happened was, the East Village Other had been run by a guy named Walter Bowert. It was, you know, just sort of this showboating hippie guy, you know, and his major achievement was, at a certain point, he married Andrew Mellon's granddaughter, you know, and just sort of walked into a millions of dollars. And when that happened, a guy who'd been, I guess, the accountant there, named Joel Fabricant, somehow seized the situation and took over. And then there you go. Suddenly, we had a guy who was like a Republican, who didn't even read the paper, who was really more like a, some kind of a, well, he was a certified public accountant. He had mob ties. He was kind of an unsavory character, but he was also kind of a pretty decent guy in his own way. And he put things on a paying basis instead of just shining me on. Suddenly, here was a guy who was actually willing to pay me $40 a week cash to work on the thing, and there was good fringe benefits that went with it. He took care of us. If he ever made a promise, he kept it. You know, in his own roughneck way, he was this really honorable guy. You know, at first I was thinking, who is this guy? Where the fuck is he coming from? And he told me, like, that he didn't even read the East Village Other. I took him to task on that. I said, what do you don't read it? I mean, you put this thing out, you don't even read it. And after that, he started, you know, sort of making a point of telling me when he'd read an article. And he always read my strip, and he'd say, like, Joel Fabricant criticism would be like, Kim, I read your strip this week, and I did not understand it. You know, which is a criticism I would take seriously, because, boy, you know, I was earning while I was learning. You know, there was plenty of weeks where, you know, my strips weren't the greatest in those days. You know, it was like, you know, it was beginner work, you know, and I was damn lucky to have that situation. And the person that got me that situation was Joel Fabricant. And, you know, by the time I left Evo, I loved that man. You know, for all of his faults and all of his political incorrectness, you know, I don't know. I was just drawn to him. He was a half-breed Jew like me. I always tend to get along with them. And I appreciated his honesty. I felt that, you know, he had some problems, and they caught up with him, too. I mean, the guy died young, and boy, I missed him. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, you know, I still haven't quite got over, you know. When I think about him, you know, I get a real pang. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like I think he was just headed for bad things. I mean, he died of an OD on heroin, which surprised me because, you know, he wasn't doing that when I was dealing with him at the East Village Other. But I don't know. I tend to be able to get along with kind of roughneck characters. I've known enough of them. I guess, in a way, maybe I got a streak of that myself.
Well, he also gave you guys free rent, didn't he, you in Spain?
At one point, you know, when we got flushed out of our place, you know, there was this sort of loft where, you know, if you were sort of displaced, you could go. And we had free drinking privileges at this nightclub called the Steve Paul Scene. We could charge all our art supplies. He took care of us. And, you know, I'll stick up for him till the day I die. I mean, I know he wasn't a perfect guy or anything, but...
He did good by you.
He did great by me, you know, and I'll never pass up an opportunity to praise his memory.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, with the that place that he gave you, it was an eighth floor walk up, was it?
Yeah, where we ended up, I think it was over on 4th Street. Yeah, there was like, you know, there were two different Puerto Rican social clubs just walking up to it. You know, it was hard to walk out of there to the street without getting stoned before you were out the front door. You know, because you had, you know, these thugs, you know, yeah.
This was the,
you know, they're offering you dope. I mean, you know, be glad they're offering you dope instead of trying to mug you.
So this wasn't the building in Weirdo 11 and the Mine Shaft 18 with the glue huffers and the...
No, that's the one we'd gotten flushed out of. And, well, in those days, I carried a gun. Mm. So, you know, and the neighborhood knew I carried a gun. So, you know, sort of a standoff. And that's why we left, is the last time they busted through that hole, they got the gun. And me and Spain looked at each other and said, it's time to go.
So they were glue freaks that were coming through the hole into your apartment.
Yeah, what happened was, you know, I've been on the Lower East Side for a while. I was getting to learn the drill. I had a police lock. I got window locks. I really had things pretty well together where we were living, and, you know, by the time Spain moved in. But then what happened was, while I was off with my girlfriend one weekend, there was a fire next door. And the firemen came. Nobody was home next door. So they come bursting into our place. They ripped the window lock right out, you know, unceremoniously, to get over on the fire escape, to get into that place. And so that was great. And then, since the place was burned out, nobody was renting in there anymore. And so these fool glue heads moved in, who were like a whole different, you know, I thought I'd seen it all with, you know, junkies and various kinds of punks around the street. And I pretty much even come to an understanding with them, you know. I'm packing, and if you want to fuck with me, go ahead and try. You never know, you might succeed. On the other hand, a loose cannon like me, anything could happen. But these glue heads were like a breed apart, you know. Suddenly, I'd had every kind of thing stolen from me, you know, that was pawnable or hawkable, but suddenly the glue heads, you know, like, they would steal paintings and shit. Mm. And, or, you know, that's when I stopped being a rock and roll fan. They got my record collection, and they took all the, you know, they took all the Otis Redding albums, all my 45s, but they left all my 78s. So, you know, I just kind of, you know, built up the 78s and let the rock and roll go by, you know. Let some other asshole collect that stuff. I'm getting tired of it anyway.
Now, you were also rooming with Simon at the time?
Later on.
Because in Weirdo 11, you talk about the place and collaborating on a piece.
Okay, well, and you know what it is that story, everything in that story is true, but I've jiggled a lot of things around. And, you know, there was a period where I was living on Mott Street for about 3 months, and at that time, Simon lived on the same floor with me in another apartment. Everything in that story is true, except I kind of removed Spain and put Simon into it, and you know, jiggled the time and place of a lot of different things. But, you know, otherwise, you know, it's all factual otherwise, but I changed the names and it's a piece of fiction. But
well,
Simon did meet the Pope. I mean, you know, he told me that story, and Jesus, that's a hot one. It took me 10 years, but I finally found a chance to use it, you know. What happened was, with my girlfriend, we started taking some creative writing courses, and I wrote that story, you know, in one of the creative writing classes, and then at a certain point, I don't know, I just, I had an opportunity to do, somebody wanted something about the 60s for a magazine, and I thought, well, you know, okay, maybe I'll turn that short story into something by adding pictures. And I guess that was the beginning of me starting to experiment with this illustrated fiction thing, because it was also the very same time that I was starting to get really gassed at by illustrated Victorian fiction in a big way. So that story was sort of my homage to, you know, like the Dickens and Thackeray approach to illustrated fiction.
I want the whole world to know.